It's 4:36. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard. Our next guest says the country is dividing itself into two Americas. In one, there's opportunity, nurturing parents for kids, and the chance to advance yourself through merit for young people. In the other America, it's getting harder and harder to finish college and move anywhere but down on the socioeconomic ladder.
Robert Putnam joins us now. He's advised Presidents Bush, Clinton, and Obama. You may recognize his name because he wrote Bowling Alone, a book that still has influence today as a description of how people are less connected today, not just at the bowling alley.
Robert Putnam is a Malkin Professor of Public Policy at Harvard University. His new book is called Our Kids, The American Dream in Crisis. Bob, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks very much, Veronica. Good to speak with you.
Well, you said that we're becoming two Americas. Can you explain what you see in those two Americas?
Sure. The big trends behind this are, first of all, the growing income gap that people know about, that is the growing gap between rich folks and poor folks. And secondly, a little less known but still very important, is that we're increasingly segregated by social class. That is, rich folks are increasingly living in rich enclaves and poor folks living in poor enclaves. We're less likely to go to school with people or even to marry people from a different social background than we used to be. So that basic split, those pair of splits in the society as a whole are having big consequences for our kids. And what our research shows is a growing gap between rich kids and poor kids on many particular measures. By the way, when I say rich kids and poor kids, I don't mean Bill Gates' kids and some homeless person. I mean gap between the upper third of American society, which is basically college-educated America, and the lower third of American society, which is basically high school-educated America. Kids from those two different kinds of backgrounds are increasingly divergent in the amount of time and money their parents invest in them, in the quality of schools they go to, in their test scores, in the amount of mentoring and other support they get from their communities, in the stability of their families. And all of those gaps together mean, as you say, that there's a big gap between rich kids and poor kids in how likely they are to get a college degree, which is, in some sense, the most important credential you can get in terms of your lifetime income.
And you say that in recent history it hasn't always been like this, and you take as a case study your own hometown, Port Clinton, Ohio, as kind of a representative for the country as a whole. Back in the 1950s, you were growing up there. What did you see in terms of opportunity for kids who are rich and kids who are poor?
Well, I want to be clear that it's not just what I remember, but we went back and did an exhaustive study of how things had turned out for my classmates, the class of 1959. Port Clinton and America was not perfect, of course, in the 1950s. There were serious racial gaps then, and there remain racial gaps today. And there was a glass ceiling that prevented my female classmates from finishing college at the same rate that my male classmates did. So it was not perfect, but basically in those years, coming from that place and time, what we found is a remarkable degree of upward mobility was characteristic of my classmates. 80% of us did better than our parents did, and the kids from the wrong side of the tracks, so to speak, did just about as well as the kids coming from the right side of the tracks. That is true for people in Port Clinton. There happens to have been a study of Wisconsin high school graduates in just about the same period, and basically the same kind of findings were true then. In that time and in those places across America, it was not perfect, I repeat, but it was in terms of social class did not matter so much for your chances in life. If you go back to Port Clinton now, kids coming from the wrong side of the tracks now have been very hard hit, as of course Wisconsin has too, by deindustrialization, the disappearance of jobs for working class people. And so poor kids today in Port Clinton are living really lives of desperation. It's hard even to describe how alone, isolated, and how poor their prospects are. At the same time, Port Clinton happens to be located on Lake Erie, has a lovely lake shore. When I was there, it was mostly orchards and fishing camps. Now it's essentially one long gated community, about 20 miles long and about 150 yards deep, and the kids and mostly million-dollar mansions along there. So the kids coming now in Port Clinton, kids who are coming from that affluent enclave, are just living in a different universe from the kids who are living from the other side of the tracks. If you drive down Port Clinton, down East Harbor Road in Port Clinton today, and you look to the left toward the lake, the child poverty rate is zero. But if you look just the other side of the road, what you see are dilapidated double wides and shacks and so on, and the child poverty rate there is 50%. Kids coming from the shoreline drive BMW convertibles to school. Many of the kids coming from the wrong side of the tracks drive to school in cars, in junkers that they live in. It's just an astonishing contrast in this little tiny town, and that captures what's been happening nationwide. We've done the same research all over America, Orange County and Boston and Bend, Oregon, and Atlanta and Philadelphia and so on, and we find the same basic pattern, this growing gap, growing opportunity gap, all over America.
And how representative of the United States as a whole would you say that case study of Port Clinton is? Is this the story all over the country?
Well, that's what I just finished saying. We didn't do the study only in Port Clinton. We begin with Port Clinton just because I happen to know it very well and because it is such a stark reality there now. You might expect to find big class gaps, in Los Angeles or New York or even Chicago, but you don't expect to find it in a small town like Port Clinton. But the book, Our Kids, that I've just written, not only has stories of the lives of these kids in all of these places that I described, but also has lots and lots of data and charts showing that nationwide, Port Clinton, the experience in Port Clinton is actually typical of what's happening to rich kids and poor kids all across the country.
And you also point out that there are two things when we have discussions like these, two things that get conflated a lot, and one is widening income inequality, and the other is an opportunity gap. Why is that difference significant here in what we're looking at?
Well, Americans have historically not cared as much about purely income differences between people in terms of how well they do in life. We assume if everybody's getting on the ladder at the same point, and some people climb up higher, Bill Gates or Warren Buffett earn more income, Americans have tended to assume, well, that's okay, they just are probably better climbers or they work harder at it or whatever. But that's on the assumption that kids are all getting on the ladder at the same point. That point, that is the equality of opportunity for kids, the idea that how well you do in life should depend upon your own talents and your own hard work, but shouldn't depend upon what your parents did or didn't do, that issue of equality of opportunity is much more fundamental to Americans, always has been, has not been a matter of party dispute, and that's the issue that I'm focusing on here. Of course, there's a relationship between the growing income gap and the growing opportunity gap, but I think when you look at kids, a lot of the arguments that you might have about the adults, they should just pull themselves up by their bootstraps and so on, that just doesn't make sense when you're talking about kids who are already, before they even get to school, are displaying these very sharp differences in soft skills, in test scores, in all of the ingredients of childhood that go to make up, your chances in life. That's why I focus on the kids, because I think we all ought to be able to agree. And as I talk to people, from across the political spectrum, I spent some time at his request talking with Paul Ryan. He and I don't agree on everything politically, but he doesn't doubt for a moment that the fact that there's this growing opportunity gap between rich kids and poor kids is a serious problem. Then the question is, of course, how do we fix it? That there may be very, very well be differences about that, but I think if we can at least agree on what the problem is across party lines, we have some hope of breaking through this incredible polarization in American politics.
Just to follow up, you were talking to Paul Ryan, obviously of great interest here in Wisconsin. Did he give you any idea about action that he might think was appropriate to take to address this?
Well, you can look at, I don't want to go into detail of what he told me personally, but you can look at his programs, and he has, some ideas. He can speak for himself about those ideas. They aren't in all respects the same as the ideas I would suggest. Rather than telling you what he proposes to do about it, I think you can, get him on your program and ask him what he thinks to do about narrowing the opportunity gap. But I think it involves doing lots of things that, in effect, mean we should be investing more of our time and energy in poor kids, not just in our own biological kids, The title of my book, Our Kids, is designed to convey the fact that back in an earlier period, like as when I was growing up in Port Clinton, when my parents used the term our kids, they didn't mean just my sister and me. They meant all the kids in town. They meant when they said, you know, we ought to invest more in, so you know, have a bond issue so that we could have a better swimming pool at school or a French department or whatever, they didn't mean that just for my sister and me. But they meant that for all the kids in town. And they kept voting for those things long after my sister and I were long gone from Port Clinton. Nowadays, however, when people talk about our kids, doing things for our kids, they mean their own biological kids. If you go back to Port Clinton now and you talk to people about the kids growing up now on the wrong side of the tracks, they say, well, those are not my kids. Those are somebody else's kids. Let them worry about it. And that shriveling of our sense of what counts as our kids is, I think, the underlying challenge here. And I think it will be better off for the whole country, including my grandchildren, who are going to be fine. They're going to be better off. Not they're not going to be hurt by doing more things for poor kids. They're going to be better off because the whole country will be richer.
So is it fair to say that there may not just be an opportunity gap, but there might be an empathy gap?
Well, yeah, there probably is a growing empathy gap in America between you know, rich folks and poor kids. And that's important. That's why I tell the stories in the book, repeatedly tell stories about, you know, different pairs of families, rich families and poor families in different places all across the country. But I think I want to emphasize that it's not just about empathy. It's not just a moral issue. I mean, I do think actually it's a moral issue. We have responsibility for all these kids. But I also think it makes economic sense for everybody to invest in all of the kids. We will all be better off. Well, the economy will grow more rapidly. We'll have less spending on criminal justice. We'll have less. The medical bills won't be as large as they will be otherwise because these poor kids are setting themselves up for long term ill health. The best econometric estimate is that it will cost the rest of us if we fail to invest in the 20, 25 million poor kids in America, if we fail to invest in their futures, it'll cost the rest of us about $5 trillion over their lifetime.
We're talking right now with Harvard social scientist Bob Putnam. His new book is called Our Kids, The American Dream in Crisis.
And we want to hear from you. Do you think that there are two Americas, one for rich people, one for poor people? And do you think that it's harder to move up the ladder if you're in a lower socioeconomic background? We'd like to hear your story. Do you think you could do what you've done in your life today? We'd like to hear more about that. Call 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Mike Arnold.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking about the American dream right now. Our guest says that it is in crisis as today's young people grow up in what he calls an opportunity gap when it's becoming increasingly hard to move up the ladder if you come from a lower socioeconomic class. Bob Putnam from Harvard University stays with us. His new book is called Our Kids.
And we want to hear from you. Do you still believe in the American dream for your kids? Did you move up the ladder from a lower socioeconomic background? And how did you get there? Do you think you could do it today? Maybe you're in a situation where you feel like, wow, you know, I don't know if my kids are going to be able to make it. We'd like to hear your story. Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Going to go to our callers now. We've got Brandon on the line in Lac des Flambeaux. Brandon, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, thanks. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that we've got a great discussion going here, and I agree on many levels. I think that until our entire nation invests equally, you know, with the disadvantaged segments of our society, we're going to continue to face these uphill battles. You know, I'm speaking from literally experience, and I by no means have made it in today's world. But you know, I work very hard and. For what little bit I do have, it sometimes seems like it's, am I making any progress due to it's so complex. We have the issue of race. We have the issue of, discussion now, you know, economic, socioeconomic status. And I really think that one of the things that we really have to talk about here also is, young people making mistakes. So we talk about the children or the kids on the other side of the tracks. You know, a lot of times those particular segments of our communities and our society, they make unwise or maybe risque decisions at a young age, and then they're tarnished. Their entire future is tarnished by a youthful mistake. And I really think that, you know, our society as a whole has to look at the criminal justice system and look at a more holistic approach to, you know, making wrongs right rather than the penal system as it is, where it's so punitive and, you know.
Got it, Brandon. Thank you for that. Appreciate your thoughts there. And it's something you get in your book, too, Bob, about these mistakes that people make when they're young and having turns in life that might not work out. Having a place to crash, has a safety net with family, a place to live, someone to loan you money. Do people still have that?
Well, you know, I first of all, I thought Brandon's comments were all very wise and sensible. I begin with the idea that basically all kids make mistakes. Your kids, my kids, rich kids, poor kids, black kids, brown kids, white kids, all kids make mistakes. They do dumb things. They drink too much, or they get involved with drugs, or they make an unwise romantic decision, or they get in a fight with a teacher, or you know, they back the car into the next door neighbor's garage. All kids do that. But when that happens to kids coming from affluent, educated homes, you know, my kids and my grandchildren, instantly airbags inflate to protect the kids from the worst aspects of their mistakes. So if your child gets involved with drugs, you find a good lawyer and you find the best rehab facility in the state, and it's not like you don't admonish the child, but the airbag allows the kid to learn from mistakes and move on. When exactly the same thing happens in the light, precisely the same mistake gets made by a poor kid, no airbags, because these kids are so isolated from everybody. They're isolated from their parents. They're isolated from family, from community, from churches. They're no longer as involved in religious communities as they used to be. And absent airbags mean that these kids are, as you said, they make one mistake and it's all over. Whereas my grandchild makes the same mistake, and you know, we dust pick him up and dust him off and help him to get forward. I'm not saying that is anything wrong about airbags. I'm just saying, kids from the upper half of American society have airbags. Kids from the lower society don't.
Well, thank you for that call. Appreciate that. And we're going to move on next to Harry joining us in Madison. Hi, Harry.
Hi. I do agree that there's definitely a division between classes. However, I grew up with an abusive alcoholic father, but yet I have become a productive part of society. And I have done very well with what, and I think it goes back to the individual. You have to have the innate desire to want to succeed. And instead of playing the, well, woe is me card, because of this situation or that situation, I can achieve my dreams.
And Harry is talking here, Bob, about, I guess, our traditional idea of the American dream. Harry saying he was able to move himself out of his circumstances through sheer hard work and grit and skill, and that's the foundation of what we think of as that dream. What do you say to Harry in his circumstance?
Well, first of all, I congratulate Harry on getting out of a bad situation and making his life better. That's terrific. But what I have to say is the evidence shows that that's getting harder and harder for kids growing up nowadays, harder than it was 20 years ago or 30 years ago or 40 years ago. I don't know, of course, I don't know the details of Harry's life, but whereas 30 or 40 years ago, most poor kids had two parents, because having only a single parent was pretty rare nowadays. Having only one parent nowadays is characteristic of about 7% of kids coming from college-educated backgrounds. That's the upper third. But having a single parent is true of about 70% for kids coming from lower-class backgrounds, what we used to call working-class backgrounds. So that challenge, and it is, of course, a challenge, the child is not responsible for their parents' behavior. It would be nutty, morally, to say that these poor kids are responsible for what their parents did or didn't do. But more and more poor kids are growing up behind the eight ball, and not only in terms of the family structure, but also in terms of the quality of schools they go to, because our schools and our lives are increasingly segregated into rich enclaves and poor enclaves. Today, rich kids are much more likely to belong to a church and therefore have people in the congregation looking out for them. They're much more likely to be involved in community activities and extracurricular activities. They're much more likely to have a coach who might look after them, or a good teacher look after them. That's what's changed over the last 20, 30, 40 years. Not just the family structure, but also the willingness of other people in the community to step in and give people a handout. And I don't mean a handout, but I mean a help. And so I think it's great that that Harry did what he was able to do, but it just is. It's simply no longer true that that's as easy for kids coming from the wrong side of the tracks as it is now for kids coming from the right side of the tracks.
So, Bob, as we get ready to wrap up, what can we do about it? The government is deadlocked. People actively dislike Congress. Some of those social fabric supports have broken down, as you chronicled in Bowling Alone. So where do the solutions come from?
Well, you know, I will respond to that in terms of some policy suggestions. But in the end, I don't think this is mostly a debate for policy wonks. I think the fundamental challenge here is to get Americans once again to realize we have responsibilities, and our self-interest is bound up in all the kids in our community, not just our own biological kids. The book lays out some big solutions that would make would make a big difference. Increasing investments in early childhood education, early childhood development. We know that that would work. The evidence is now overwhelmingly clear that, kids coming from affluent backgrounds get read Goodnight Moon to a lot more than working class kids do, and then we know that that affects brain development. So early childhood education would be a big program that make a lot of difference. But there are also some smaller things that we could do even in our own communities. For example, mentoring. There's a huge gap in the availability of neighbors or as I say, congregation members or coaches or whatever. There's a gap in the availability of those. So I take a very specific example. It's one among many in the last chapter of the book. There's a big gap nowadays in taking part in extracurricular activities. It didn't used to be that there was any difference between the likelihood that a rich kid and a poor kid would play football or band or chorus or whatever.
And we have to leave it there. I'm so sorry, but Bob, a fascinating conversation. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
That was Bob Putnam. His book is called Our Kids, The American Dream in Crisis.
It's Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.